James A. Pike became the fifth bishop of California in 1958, and we're told Grace Cathedral in San Francisco became a central defining force during his time in that position. Among his initiatives, Pike invited Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to speak at the cathedral after the Selma March in 1964. He also commissioned stained glass windows featuring astronaut John Glenn and Justice Thurgood Marshall, as we're told by Art Peterson of Found SF. On June 7th the following year, Bishop Pike sent the following letter to composer and pianist Vince Guaraldi. "My dear Mr. Guaraldi, I still cannot get over my excitement and enthusiasm after hearing your contemporary setting for the Holy Eucharist that evening last month. I was particularly impressed with your work because of the manner which you employed in integrating the traditional and familiar plain song tunes with a very elegant and modern harmonic structure. Musicians are often quite wooden because they are unable to get away from traditional tonal structures, no matter how out of touch those structures might be with a modern man's listening ear. There's nothing wooden about your composition and performance of the Guaraldi Mass, and I was both honored and awestruck at the tremendous beauty and sensitivity of your work. I certainly look forward to the completion of recordings of the Guaraldi Mass, and I would be honored if I could possibly make some comments about the performance and the work on the record jacket. Once again, thank you for everything you have done, and may God bless you in all your work. With every best wish and warmest regards, sincerely, J.A.P. And that was from the Most Reverend James A. Pike. And the letterhead, the Diocese of California, 1055 Taylor Street in San Francisco. That is the letter that Bishop Pike sent, and he noted in his remarks to Vince Guaraldi that he was looking forward to the completion of recordings of the Mass that Vince Guaraldi composed for Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. Vince Guaraldi of Charlie Brown fame, believe it or not. And that is where we pick up the story. There will be a performance of the Guaraldi Mass on August 31st at the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit because the pastor there actually transcribed the entire Mass from the key recording. Reverend Bill Carter is not just pastor there, but he is an admired jazz pianist, composer, arranger, and bandleader, and author, too. Carter stopped in at the WVIA studios to tell the tale of the Mass by Vince Guaraldi, the performance on the 31st, and the visit from Guaraldi's biographer, Derek Bang.
It's a funny thing. I was in Main Street Music, which is a CD store in Stroudsburg, fumbling through the used CDs, and this is probably, late 1990s. And I came across the Vince Guaraldi Mass, and I thought, what? Guaraldi at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, the Episcopal Cathedral on Nob Hill. And I thought, well, this is interesting. So I took it home, and it was kind of a mishmash of things. First of all, a lot of the elements of a Mass were there. However, that wasn't any kind of sequence that looked like a liturgy. There was an introduction by Bishop James Pike, who greeted everybody. So I thought, this is big. And the liner notes said a little bit, but I really didn't know the backstory. And it was kind of a serendipity meeting on the phone and then by email with Derek Bang, who is Guaraldi's biographer, has become a fast friend. And that was at the end of 2014. I was realizing that our annual jazz service at First Presbyterian Church for Christmas, we could do the music from a Charlie Brown Christmas and kind of weave it in. We needed to freshen it up. In the meantime, Derek had written a very affirming review of the Presby Bop concert we did here in the studio at the Sardoni Theater, WVIA. And we instantly connected, and one thing led to another. And in August 15th, 2015, I was in San Francisco, Grace Cathedral, for for a concert setting and presentation of the Mass with my friend Jim Martinez, who's a jazz pianist. We worked with his trio, and I spoke. The transcript of my little homily or sermon ended up in my book. And it's been kind of a hoot ever since, and now it's 10 years later, and time to do it again.
Bill, tell us, who was the one responsible for making the original music of the Mass available for such a celebration?
Well, that was all my work for the most part. The Garaldi Mass has never been written down officially, probably won't be. And so I listened to the CD and transcribed it from the recording, which also was tricky. Garaldi, in his rehearsal, never did it the same way twice. And he was using a setting of the Missa Marialis, from the Episcopal Red Hymnal of 1940, a plain chant. He wanted to do something that was familiar with the people so they didn't come after him with pitchforks. And as you'll hear with my conversation with Derek, a few wanted to, maybe more than a few. Yeah, we've been having some fun. We may have a choir of as many as 35 people from First Presbyterian Church and Our Lady of the Snows Roman Catholic Church, both in Clark Summit, for this August 31st presentation in worship of the Garaldi Mass. It will be preceded at 9:30 by a talk by Derek Bang, Garaldi's biographer. We're bringing him in from Davis, California. And he'll speak for about 25 minutes and then kind of set the context of how this was composed, what had been put together, and we'll go on from there.
Who are the members of the Presby Pop Ensemble who will be with you?
Well, we have the ubiquitous Tony Marino on bass. We have Tyler Dempsey on drums, and we have Mike Carbone on flute, which wasn't original in the instrumentation. But if you're doing Garaldi music and maybe, you know, kind of veering into a little Charlie Brown music, a little flute or soprano sax just seasons it perfectly.
And you, of course, at the piano. Before we meet Derek Bang, Bill, tell us some of the musical insights you had while you were transcribing the Mass. What might we notice if we're listening?
What's fascinating is some of the choral music and the settings that Garaldi put together will later resemble Charlie Brown music. You know, when the choir and the congregation chant the Nicene Creed on a single note, a G, the chords that he lays down are the same chords that he will use for A Charlie Brown Christmas for the tune Skating, which is the opening tune when the kids are catching the snowflakes on their tongues. There are other little pieces, his signature piece for that, the Mass theme for Grace. It sounds a little bit like Christmas Time Is Here, some of the descending minor ninth chords. And you'll hear this, which is kind of fascinating. And it's because a jazz composer is a bit of a seed picker who takes a twig from this and a little piece of yarn from that and stitches together a new nest from existing material in their imagination. You know, it's a common misconception that jazz improvisers pull the music out of the air. They don't. They dig it out of the soil. It's been fermenting for a while, and they have probably played pieces of this before, but it's how they stitch it together into new configurations and melodies that makes it so fascinating. And they'll take a little bit of something and then develop it, tug it, turn it upside down, play it in a different cluster of notes. And Garaldi was a genius at this. He was also very influenced by Brazilian music, which seemed to have landed in southern and central California before it landed in other places. So a lot of his music is Latinized. So when we get to parts of the Mass, the Sanctus and the Agnus Dei, they're kind of set to a couple of chords that just keep going to a Latin beat. And the choir essentially chants it over the top of this rhythm. So it's, you know, it's a hoot. It's just so much fun. What amazes me, and I've said this to some of my musical friends, according to Garaldi's biographer, it took about 11 months to put this piece together. And I look at it now and I think, how in the world did it take that long? But I have to remember, He was fighting a lot of opinions about whether or not jazz should be in a church in 1965, even though it was San Francisco, where folks are a bit more open than others of us. And he also was dealing with a church choir that was accustomed to singing what is on the page, not what is in the air. And that is a dramatic difference. It would take a while, and it was a lot of Saturday mornings. Near the end of the process, he brought in his bass player and drummer, and they kind of worked on it. But once again, he never played some of the chant-like music the same way twice, which essentially terrorized that very conventional Episcopalian choir. But there are legacies here, too. One of the children in the children's choir at the Mass later was chosen to sing for a Charlie Brown Christmas when they sing a couple of the Christmas carols at the end, or Christmas Time Is Here. And he remembers that this happened on a midweek choir rehearsal, a kids' choir rehearsal, and a van took these children into San Francisco from the suburbs, paid them all $5 and an ice cream cone, and brought them back, never mentioning to the parents where they were or what they were up to. So you had frantic parents back in the parking lot wondering where their children were. Before cell phones, practically in the day of telegraph, and Giraldi said, oh yeah, we probably should let somebody know. But you can hear their voices every Christmas. Christmas Time Is Here and Hark the Herald Angels Sing.
Reverend Bill Carter, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit, speaking with us about his involvement in the Mass by Vince Guaraldi that was written for the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco and performed there to great acclaim. There will be a performance of the Mass on August 31st at the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit. And there will be a visit from Giraldi's biographer, Derek Bang. Derek Bang is the author of several books on Charles Schulz and Peanuts, and he did write this biography titled Vince Guaraldi at the Piano, and it is in a second edition. And we asked Bill Carter if he would reach out to Derek Bang and have a conversation, since they were close friends, to fill us in on the way this whole project, the project that would bring jazz pianist and composer Vince Guaraldi to Grace Cathedral, writing a Mass for a very special occasion.
Thanks for talking with us about the Guaraldi Mass.
Oh my goodness, I love talking about the Guaraldi Mass. It pains me that he is not better remembered for having achieved this milestone accomplishment.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece of music. Well, tell us, how did this unlikely occurrence come about?
Well, let me sidebar that question with a moment of serendipity or cosmic coincidence, because that's really what makes this story even more interesting. So let's go back to late 1963, when producer Lee Mendelssohn has decided to do a documentary about Charles Schulz. He knows he's going to be working with animator Bill Melendez, who's going to supply some brief bits of animation. And Mendelssohn, being a jazz fan, wanted jazz music to accompany those little animated segments. He first asked and was turned down by Cal Chater and Dave Brubeck. So he's wondering, okay, so who am I going to get? And I know this is going to sound fictitious all these years later, but I swear this is the way it happened. He's driving across the Golden Gate Bridge one day. He's got KSFO on his car radio, listening to a jazz show hosted by Al Jazbo Collins, who at that particular moment played Giraldi's then Grammy Award-winning hit, Cast Your Fate to the Wind. And Mendelssohn immediately thought, that's the music I want. So he got in touch with Giraldi, pitched the idea to him, and Giraldi accepted. Okay, so Now let's answer the question you asked. June 8th, 1964, not quite a year later. It's a Monday morning. Then 20-something Reverend Charles Gomperz was reading that day's San Francisco Chronicle, which was talking about, as it had been for quite some time, the fact that the city's Grace Cathedral was soon to become the first major Anglican cathedral consecrated in the United States. Now, this particular day, there was a photo spread talking about this upcoming event, which included pictures of several church people, one of whom was the wife of Gomperz's boss, Bishop James A. Pike. And the caption under one of these photos had the group considering the thought that perhaps one of the things they could do to help bring in younger folks was to have a quote-unquote holy hootenanny. This phrase struck Gomperz as being all wrong. So he impulsively called Bishop Pike, expecting to leave a message on the bishop's phone, but Pike answered the phone, and Gomperz registered his complaint, saying that he felt that the phrase made such an event sound too trivial. And Pike said, okay, fine. The job is yours. Think of something else. Fill the cathedral. In May 1965. Well, Gomperz hung up the phone. I interviewed him several times, and he loved telling this portion of the story. And he thought, that's it. I've lost my job. I've destroyed my career. So he did what many an individual does at such a moment of crisis. He drew a warm bath. And he's lounging in the bathtub, listening to a radio in one of the other rooms in his home. And what do you suppose was played on the radio at that precise moment? It was Vince Guaraldi's Cast Your Fate to the Wind. He immediately got out of the bath, picked up the phone, made a bunch of calls, eventually reached Guaraldi that same day and pitched the concept. And there was a pause. And Vince said, well, Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, they all wrote masses. Why not me? Guaraldi had no shortage of chutzpah, and that's how it started.
Well, I'm sure it just developed easily and quickly, right? There were no challenges or obstacles?
Oh, boy. Only in the sense that nobody really knew what to do because this was totally unpaved ground. There were a couple of vaguely related predecessors that had taken place elsewhere in the United States, but we're all pretty sure that neither Gomperz nor Guaraldi knew anything about those. And so they kind of made it up as they went along. Now, Gomperz, even at that young age, was no fool. He anticipated that there might be blowback from more conservative elements. So as a result, he proposed devising the Mass around the Marbach setting of the Eucharist. It's a plain chant setting, with that as the core, and then having Guaraldi and his trio improvise around that blueprint, if you will. There'd be nothing new or radical about having the familiar hymns. The only thing that would be new and radical was how Vince would work with it. Guaraldi suggested adding a chorus, and so they began working with Barry Minia, who was the organist and choir master at St. Paul's Church in San Rafael. It was a mixed choir of children and adults, and they started rehearsing almost immediately. So over the next, well, let's see, June to the following May, so we're talking about 11 months, they spent a lot of time working this out, and I can well imagine that there were a lot of detours and missed turns and corrections and whatnot. But of course, from Guaraldi's standpoint, this is, after all, the nature of jazz. It is never something that is set in concrete.
And I'm sure all of this was written down.
Oh, golly, no. None of it. You should probably supply that particular response. No, it was never written down. In the aftermath, and of course that's cutting to the chase, but we'll call this another sidebar, numerous individuals and institutions requested copies of what had been done, but no such copies existed. Worse yet, there were no full recordings.
Was it fully recorded?
It was indeed. Gomperz hired a film crew. I believe it was Seagull Films to come in and film the entire production, if you will. Can't really call it a concert. After all, it was a mass, which lasted somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple of hours. Unfortunately, Seagull Films went out of business shortly thereafter, and Gomperz never was able to get the promised copy of what had been filmed. In terms of an audio copy, all he had were fragments, portions. And unfortunately, over time, the portions that weren't used on the resulting Fantasy Record album, Vince Guaraldi at Grace Cathedral, appear to have been lost to time. It is a tragedy.
But Fantasy did release it.
Fantasy did release the album. But again, we're getting a little ahead of the story.
Well, tell us a bit more about Guaraldi and his musical influences, and how did those influences affect what he did with the music for the Mass?
His early influences were boogie-woogie piano players, so I'd have to say not at all in that sense. But as he developed his sound, when he began working in the early 1950s as a member of Cal Tjader's trio initially and later as a member of Tjader's quintet, and also fronting his own trio at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco and other San Francisco jazz spots, and even later when he spent two sessions as the pianist in Woody Herman's third Thundering Herd. As that decade concluded, Guaraldi's sound shifted from pleasant, easygoing, pretty jazz, which is what characterized the first two albums that he released on Fantasy, to something else that he was inspired by when in the late 1950s he chanced to see the film Black Orpheus and was immediately taken by the cool, smooth bossa nova sound of the Tombs by Antonio Carlos Jobim and Louis Bonfa. And as a result, bossa nova became his passion for the next several years, and that resulted in the 1962 album, Jazz Impressions of Black Orpheus, which included the aforementioned original tune, Cast Your Fate to the Wind. So I would imagine, going into this massive project for Grace Cathedral, that one of the things that was uppermost on his mind was presenting music that would be pleasant and welcoming and cheerful to the congregation that came to attend the Mass. And he certainly delivered on that thought.
Say a bit more about how it developed. How did the project develop?
Well, piece by piece and bit by bit, Gompertz sort of played stage manager, to use a theatrical correlation. He brought people together, and then he stepped back and just let them go to work. Guaraldi initially worked with the choir as a solo pianist. He would be there every Saturday morning and occasionally Wednesday afternoon. It was only as 1964 gave way to 1965 that Guaraldi started bringing in his sidemen, Tom Beeson on bass and Lee Charlton on drums, and the trio began working with the entire choir, led by Barry Minion. And of course, there was always a little bit of tension between the two elements, because everything that Barry was doing was very specific and written down and precise, whereas everything Guaraldi and his trio were doing was spontaneous and loose. When I interviewed the now much older former choir members, several of them said one of the most simultaneously amazing and occasionally frustrating aspects of this process was that Guaraldi and his trio never performed the same tunes the same way twice. So they were never entirely certain what to expect. That obviously must have made the process more difficult. Even so, it went quite smoothly. Everybody with whom Gompertz worked in his element was very supportive of this project. They weren't entirely welcomed by the staff at Grace Cathedral, which tended to put up roadblocks here and there. It was as if they felt their territory was being invaded by, unwanted elements, shall we say. They never really stopped anything, but they never made the process simple.
For instance, you told me once about the rehearsal in the cathedral being postponed slightly because of some other things that needed to happen.
Well, that's right. The cathedral staff decided that they would get in the way as much as possible by eliminating the lengthy rehearsal time that Guaraldi and Gompertz and Barry Minia had hoped for. Even so, by that point in time, what they were doing was so tight that, you know, between you, me, and the wall, they probably didn't even need a rehearsal.
Well, say a bit more about San Francisco and the context of 1965.
It's important to remember that in the mid-1960s, San Francisco was probably one of the very few places where an event of this nature could possibly have taken place. Now, you know, I'm not going to dismiss churches in big cities such as Los Angeles or New York or Chicago, but San Francisco was primed, I think, is the best word. Much of the rest of the country, particularly the conservative elements, still felt at that point in time that jazz was, quote unquote, the devil's music and had absolutely no business being on the sacred ground of a church or cathedral. San Francisco, the attitude was a little bit looser. The local rock and roll scene was expanding as a response to the British invasion. The counterculture movement was rising equally rapidly. And let's face it, both Gompertz and Pike were impressively radical for that point in time, as further evidenced by the fact that they selected Malcolm Boyd to deliver the masses' sermon. They cheerfully expected to ruffle even more feathers with this choice. Now, you got to remember that Malcolm Boyd at that point in time was not merely a national figure. He was a nationally notorious figure. He'd become known as the radical coffeehouse priest since his 1959 appointment as Episcopal chaplain at Colorado State University. And he soon wound up at the forefront of the evolving civil rights movement. In fact, in 1961, he was one of 28 Episcopal priests who joined the Freedom Ride, which began in New Orleans. I remember Chuck Gompertz proudly telling me, and this is a direct quote, "It's true. We were trying to make a statement."
And what was the reaction then to this mass among those who were present, to the guests, and maybe even to the musicians?
Absolutely, in a word, overwhelming. The cathedral was filled to overflowing on May 21st, 1965, with people coming from as far away as San Luis Obispo, which is several hours away. During communion, consider this, more than 1,000 people came up to the altar area. This went on for well over half an hour, during which time Vince and his trio, Beeson and Charlton, continued to improvise as the jazz masters they were. Again, one of the choir members, much later when I interviewed them as an adult, said, "I just marveled at the fact that without any sheet music in front of them, they continued to play, and it was all so gorgeous." After the final amen, the congregation applauded, which was not expected in that particular setting. People and clergy gathered to congratulate everybody involved, and this after event, if you will, it wasn't exactly a party, it was just outside the building, that also lasted a long time. Chuck Gompertz said to me later, "We began to realize that we had done something much larger than all of us." Well, he spoke truth. Ralph Gleason, the San Francisco Chronicle music critic, was in attendance. He waxed rhapsodic in his column the following day, which was syndicated to newspapers across the country. The mass was granted a full-page article in Time magazine. Other national publications also picked up the story. Gompertz quipped that his mother knew that he had done something famous when he was mentioned in Reader's Digest. Unfortunately, that's when the trouble began, in the form of renewed belligerence on the part of those deeply offended by what Gompertz, Pike, Garaldi, and Boyd had done. A few weeks after the mass, Gompertz received a plain white envelope in the mail, no return address, his address printed crudely on the front. The letter inside threatened the life of Gompertz's young daughter, in first grade at the time. The writer obviously knew the girl's movements each morning as she walked to school, and cited them specifically. And the letter concluded with the ominous sentence, "We wanted to let you know that the California Minutemen are watching you." Well, fortunately, nothing happened. And all I can say is it's a good thing they didn't have social media back then.
Well, say a bit then about the legacy of this piece and this performance.
Well, golly, in the immediate aftermath, the Grace Cathedral staff, which had been so recalcitrant prior to the Garaldi Mass, couldn't act quickly enough to book a follow-up. Duke Ellington and his Concert of Sacred Music debuted there just a few months later on September 16th. Now, here's a funny story. In 2015, when a concert version of Garaldi's Jazz Mass was presented as a 50th anniversary tribute, also in Grace Cathedral, August 15th, 2015, I was there. And the cathedral's small gift shop had several copies of the Ellington album but absolutely no copies of Vince Guaraldi at Grace Cathedral. And I registered a very stiff complaint. Guaraldi presented his jazz mass half a dozen times during the next several years at venues including Stanford Memorial Church and Santa Clara University's Mission Church. It's also known to have been performed at Christ Church Cathedral in Rochester, New York, by entirely different musicians. Now, this is fun. Guaraldi later collaborated with composer music professor Lynn Shurtleff on the creation of a second, lesser-known liturgical piece called Sing Unto the Lord a New Song. Like the Grace Cathedral Mass, it blended worship songs with jazz improvisation. It debuted on December 11th that year at Santa Clara University's Mission Church with Guaraldi's trio, then Peter Marshall on bass and Mike Clark on drums, accompanied by the 115-voice Santa Clara Chorale. Alas, and is this going to sound familiar? Although that was recorded in its entirety, it has never been released commercially. And at this point in time, almost nobody knows that Guaraldi was involved in that. As for the ongoing legacy, well, heck, jazz in the church is so common these days that it's used to help entice people into worship services. And as I said earlier, I remain most bothered by the fact that Guaraldi almost never gets credit for his milestone achievement, which remains in the distant shadows of his later collaborations with Charles Schulz, Lee Mendelssohn, and Bill Melendez. I mean, it's great to be remembered for anything more than half a century later, right? But it would be nicer if you could also be remembered for all the things you did.
And in December of 1965, what happened then?
Well, December 9th, 1965, I was parked in front of the TV set. I remember the evening very well because my parents generally did not allow me to watch television on a school night. So I'm sure I was sitting there in my pajamas at 7:30 in the evening when A Charlie Brown Christmas debuted. Well, I wasn't the only person overwhelmed by that show, although it took me a couple of years to figure out that Vince Guaraldi was involved in the music because the credits zapped by much too quickly at the end of the show. Other people who watched that show included Wynton Marsalis, George Winston, David Benoit, all of whom went on to become standard bearers in terms of furthering Guaraldi's legacy. In fact, Wynton Marsalis went on record as saying, in the early 1990s, if I remember correctly, the only time you heard jazz on TV was when Charlie Brown came to town. That's when you know you've established a lasting legacy, when other artists begin covering and embracing and enhancing the music that you wrote so many years earlier. And it's an explosion which continues to this day. Every year, there is an expanding number of pop, jazz, and even rock artists who do covers of Christmas Time Is Here, Linus and Lucy, even Skating and Christmas Is Coming, the jazz rock anthem that plays in that show when the kids are dancing on stage in between acts of the play they're attempting to rehearse. It hasn't merely not stopped, it continues to expand exponentially. I mean, heck, I want to be part of whatever movement results in our attempt to make Guaraldi one of our Tchaikovskys.
And with that, let me say thank you so much, Derek. And we look forward to greeting you when you get to Clark Summit on August 31st, 10 o'clock in the morning, to hear another presentation of the Guaraldi Mass.
And who will be doing that, Bill?
I think I'll be there with my Presby Bop Quartet. And we have an interfaith choir of about almost 30 people from First Presbyterian Church in Clark Summit with Our Lady of the Snows. And we're glad you're leaving California to come to a community where you can hear about Our Lady of the Snows.
Well, you must understand that my wife and I would never miss this.
Derek Bang, who is the biographer of Vince Guaraldi, speaking with Reverend Bill Carter, pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit, and also the esteemed jazz pianist, composer, arranger, band leader of the Presby Bop Quintet in its various incarnations. And he is the one who has made it possible for us to hear the Mass in its entirety. Bill Carter sat down with the recording and transcribed the entire Mass. And so it will be performed to mark the 60th anniversary of the first performance of the Garaldi Mass, composed for Grace Cathedral in San Francisco in 1965. On hand, the Presby Bach Quartet, the combined choirs of the Presbyterian Church and Our Lady of the Snows of Clark Summit, and Derek Bang. Derek Bang is coming in from California, Vince Guaraldi's biographer. He'll be talking about Vince Guaraldi and giving insights into the creation of the Mass that we'll all have a chance to hear. That's at 9:30 on the 31st of August. And then at 10 a.m., the celebration will begin. The musical celebration will begin. Everyone is welcome. And if you need more information on the web, fpccs.org, fpccs.org. The Vince Guaraldi Mass at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. This is the 60th anniversary of that first performance, and that was the recording made at Grace Cathedral up on Nob Hill that fateful day. Cast your fate to the wind, as we heard, and it is an event that will be celebrated on Sunday, August 31st, at the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit, 300 School Street, the entire Vince Guaraldi Mass, Jazz Mass, and it will feature the Presby Bach Quartet, the combined choirs of the First Presbyterian Church and Our Lady of the Snows of Clark Summit, and Derek Bang, Vince Guaraldi's biographer, coming in from California to celebrate the occasion. He'll speak at 9:30 on that Sunday morning, and then at 10 o'clock, it will be the Guaraldi Jazz Mass performed in its entirety. For more information, on the web, fpccs.org, fpccs.org.